You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, considered the hottest podcast in the universe. Now get ready for the heat. Here's Brian Callen.
Charles, thank you. Thank you for joining us. Charles wrote a book called The Power of Habit. He's a staff writer for the New York Times, and which is really, and by the way, a Pulitzer Prize-winning staff writer. I'd wear that like a badge. I'd be so obnoxious. I just want to be a smart guy. And so instead, I just have a podcast where I bring a guy like Hunter on, and he kind of opens the world to me, and I just act like I'm smart. Now, thank you for your book. Excellent book, The Power of Habit.
And right
in line with the theme of what we've been talking about. We've had David Epstein on, and
Dan Coyle
who wrote the Talent Code, and just the idea that and Hunter's written a book called The Straight-A Conspiracy. Just the idea that, you know, talent and human behavior is not necessarily hardwired, and it is to an extent. But you know, you talk about the power of habit and how you can get essentially people to change the way they behave, and in fact probably even an entire nation. Your example of the Pepsodent toothpaste is fascinating to me. I never knew that Americans didn't brush their teeth on a regular basis until Claude Hopkins comes along, who was essentially a marketer, and said, I'm going to get people to brush their teeth with Pepsodent. I'm going to create a toothpaste that creates a tingly feeling, and you're going to have a better smile, and it's going to feel good when you drag your tongue across your teeth.
It's absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. And what's funny is that probably, you know, 30 or 40 years from now, people will look back on this period and say, I can't believe there was a time when most Americans didn't put on sunscreen every single day or something like that, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that we know is that so many of the products that we use every day in our life, or so many of the daily patterns that have been established in how we take care of ourselves or just what we do, are not only habits that we're unaware of, but are habits that were influenced, kind of designed by someone else. And teeth brushing is a great example, right? Nobody in this country, except for essentially rich people, brushed their teeth before Claude Hopkins appeared on the scene.
I cannot believe that.
That's amazing.
I just was so blown away by that.
You almost wish that that was still true, so that, you know, angry Republicans could say, you elitist toothbrushing liberal.
Actually, I think it was the Republicans who were brushing their teeth.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. Yeah, I'm sorry, but keep going. Yeah.
No, it's just, it is very, very interesting. And I think, I mean, what's particularly interesting to me is that much like the Force, this is a power that can be used for good or for evil. but what's important about it is that the more people are aware of these influences in our lives, the more empowered they are to sort of make choices about whether they want this to be something that they adopt or not. And it's really making people aware is the goal of writing the book, and I think of a lot of the advances that are happening now in behavioral economics, just to take people's brains out of this kind of turn-off period that it goes into when a habit takes over and say, look, you have the ability to decide whether you want this habit in your life or not. And that'll influence how healthy you are, how long you live, how much money you have, how you get along with your coworkers and your family. But just recognizing what's going on is incredibly important to taking control of it.
That makes total sense. When you know how your brain works, when you have an idea of the mechanisms in which you can, that's the first thing to curing essentially any kind of a disease, I think. I mean, the more we learn about cancer, for example, the better chances we have at stopping it. So that's what I find so fascinating about the new science of the brain. We seem to be learning more and more about how this machine works, this computer works. And it really, you know, I can't imagine, you know, in 50 years what we are going to, you know, just what it's going to say about, for example, the old-fashioned notions like character. You know, you got to have a character, which really means self-control. And we are very unforgiving of people who lack self-control in this country. We give them lots of chances, but, you know, if you don't have any self-control, you have no character. And so if you keep eating donuts and you're fat, well, you must have no character. Well, in fact, you know, your book kind of explains how all our minds essentially work that way. And it's a question of whether or not your habit is a good habit or a bad habit, mm-hmm. right?
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And I think that there's just a huge amount, there's still a huge amount to be learned about how we can structure the world in more positive ways, right? I mean, one of the things that's really interesting to me is the Economics Nobel Prize that was given earlier this year went to these two guys, Eugene Fama, who's kind of the father of what's known as the efficient market hypothesis, that says every price in the stock market is right, and Robert Shiller, who's the father of kind of thinking of bubbles, particularly in the housing industry. And what's interesting about this is that, and this is obviously sort of apart from the book, but what's interesting about this is that two people who said exactly opposite things both won the Nobel Prize at the same time. One of them said that people are always rational. One of them said that people are never rational, and that they're irrational in ways they can't even anticipate. And there's a battle going on right now, right? In the last decade, the amount that we've learned about how habits work in people's brains has been transformative in how we, for instance, create corporate education programs to give Starbucks employees more willpower when they're at work, and how we structure, you know, campaigns to fight obesity or to fight gambling addiction.
Wow.
We know now where habits live in the brain. We know how to affect them. But simply knowing is not enough. It's really a question of how you deliver that information in a timely manner, in a way that allows people to feel empowered to actually change how they behave.
Is there?
And that's really hard.
Yeah, well, I've always said that there's one of the good ways to do it from my experience, and I'm far from a scientist in this, obviously, but I always say that, you know, if you take the human brain and you say, well, human beings are always going toward pleasure and away from pain. My feeling is if somebody's out of shape, once they feel the difference between what it's like to feel in shape versus out of shape, and they associate that feeling with pleasure and the other with, you know, pain, that's how you start to make a change, isn't it? I mean, isn't that kind of the
absolutely
idea?
Absolutely. It's a huge part of it. You know, in the book, we talk about this concept of the habit loop, right? Mm-hmm. This is one of the big insights into neurology, is that every habit has these three components, a cue, a routine, and a reward. Mm-hmm. And what we've begun to appreciate is just how incredibly important that reward is in making a behavior automatic. But the other part of that is that oftentimes we get rewards in our lives without realizing what the reward is, without sort of deliberately making the link between a behavior we want and the reward. And a great example of this is exercise, right? We know from studies that were done in Germany that if people eat a small piece of chocolate after they go and they run in the morning, that they're more likely to develop an exercise habit, because your brain will start to associate this activity of running with something you really enjoy, like a small piece of chocolate, even though it's kind of counterintuitive to a dieter.
Right.
But think about how most people actually go exercising in the morning. They wake up, they go for a run, they get home, they're running late for work, so they like rush through their morning ritual, and then they rush out the door feeling anxious about getting to their desk. They're effectively punishing themselves for exercising.
That's right. That's right.
And as a result, it's much harder to develop that habit, because our brain latches on to whether we get a reward or a punishment after we do something. And so part of this is about deliberately saying, I'm going to let myself enjoy this reward. I'm going to give myself a reward and actually let myself enjoy it, because without that, you lose the neurological power of the reward at the end of the habit loop.
That's makes awesome. A lot of sense. Isn't there though the idea that some really good teachers a lot of times will sort of, and I don't know if this speaks to your point, but they will sort of, like, for example, I remember when I used to do a little, you know, fighting, a little boxing and stuff in Taekwondo, and I was hitting a bag, and I said to my teacher, I said, you know, I can't figure out what my mother means by concentrate. I don't have good focus, and I my mind always wanders, and I keep trying to concentrate. And he said, do me a favor. I said, well, he said, hit the bag, and just jab it. We were working on the jab, and I jabbed it. And if you jab, it's, you know, it's like you think of it as a cat, the way a cat grabs your arm. Just no muscle, just really loose, bang, just touch it, bang, you know, and come back. And he said, did you think about that? And I said, no. He said, what were you thinking? I said, I don't know, I just jabbed. He said, that same mindset should be applied to reading or study, and take the, what he was trying to do essentially is take the precious fence around anything that was going to require accomplishment, right? So I've got to go work. We have this notion in our society where I've got to go do work. I've got to go write. We are separating that from our everyday lives and that which we do anyway. And I feel like your book speaks a little bit to that point in a way. I mean, you can kind of create habit out of, you can create pleasurable habits in a way by taking, I guess, I'm trying to explain what I mean, but taking the sacredness away from it, the precious sort of fencing around it. Just
absolutely.
Refocus the eye, right?
You know, it's interesting. Like, there's a within psychology right now, they call this mindfulness, right? The trying to teach yourself to kind of be more in the moment, and you know, there's this term flow about sort of when you're involved in work where you essentially lose track of time and sort of lose track. And it's not necessarily what no one is saying that, like, flow or mindfulness, that those moments of just kind of being and reacting, that those are necessarily pleasurable. It's not like it's an ecstasy. What it is it's deeply, deeply satisfying. Right. And I think that this is what, when you think about how habits influence your life, or when you think about unconscious versus conscious behaviors, one of the things that tends to happen is that you can make things that are deeply satisfying more and more automatic. So attention's a great example, right? We know that people can pay better attention if they practice paying attention. As it becomes a habit, as it becomes more of an unconscious or automatic behavior, when they're reading or when they're working, it feels less effortful. And as a result, it feels more satisfying. That doesn't mean it's more fun. But the truth of the matter is that fun is actually less pleasurable in a lot of ways than something that's deeply satisfying. And so that's kind of the goal, is to say, I want to get to a place where I work every day and I feel deeply satisfied by it, as opposed to I just had like an ecstatic time, or I had fun the entire time I was working out. Because no one has fun the entire time they're working out.
Yeah, I mean,
you can make it automatic and deeply satisfying.
Changing our terminology is really important. I mean, as you were talking about fun, I was like, yeah, if I'm in Vegas and I'm doing ecstasy and dancing with, you know, three really hot hookers, not that I would do that, Charles, because I'm not that kind of guy.
And he's married.
And I'm married. So, and now that I'm married, my habit is complete and total monogamy, and
yeah.
I love it. You know, that does speak to a point, though, where, you know, at times it's like, it's kind of fun to have bad habits, isn't it? I mean, we're also wired for that.
Well, oh, absolutely. Yeah. We need bad habits, right? We need bad habits and we need good habits. And most habits that we have are actually good habits, right? Mm. They make life easier for us. Mm-hmm. And some of the bad habits aren't that bad because they really like them. Like, I like having a dessert after dinner. I mean, I would love to be in great shape and have like 6-pack abs.
Well, I'll send you a picture of my torso. Okay. Put it up on your wall so every day you can.
Feel inadequate.
That'll be your reward. It'll be your reward, man. No, but go on. Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, to be honest, I like desserts more than I would like having a 6-pack. And so, like, and it's not bad to like have these habits that other people would say are bad habits, and to indulge them. Like, that's kind of the point of life, is to do some things you enjoy.
100%.
Well, and
100%.
You know, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who's the guy who is responsible for flow, like, that's his work, he draws the distinction between pleasures and gratifications. And gratifications are those experiences that are deeply satisfying, and pleasures are things like hookers in Vegas.
Yeah.
Right? Or dessert or anything
just,
like
I
that.
I just put my hand on my pants. I'm sorry, that's such a reaction.
He often has his hands on his pants. But the thing that Martin Seligman, who, you know, is the founder of positive psychology, always talks about is the fact that, you know, your life should be like a chocolate chip cookie. It should be mostly gratifications, but there's something wrong if you don't have those pleasures sprinkled in as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you know when you're in that stage, right? When you feel sort of, when you feel like life is just going well because you're feeling productive and you're feeling satisfied and you're feeling like there's these bits of pleasure, but it's not like you're like stuffing your face with the Oreos.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a side to that I see in myself and in other people. There is sort of this idea I see with people that they I don't know that people really want to be that effective and perfect sometimes. I really feel like we almost embrace our own flaws, and even our friends, you know, there's this idea that, you know, he's got bad habits, but that makes him a lot more colorful. Mm-hmm. You know, I suppose if I were to work out 4 hours a day and there were things I could do where I could look more symmetrical and things, but I don't want to be that guy. It speaks to your point of just kind of, I guess maybe, you know, human beings are also, maybe bad habits in some weird way create a balance to our personality. you know?
I think so. I think so. I think what people do want is they want to feel in control. Mm-hmm. So they want to feel like if I have a bad habit, I'm making a conscious decision to allow myself to have this bad habit. And what's really important is that self-perception is a huge part of this. So there's this really interesting piece in The New Yorker last week about Merck's push to create a new sleeping pill. And it's talking about Ambien, which is the dominant sleeping pill right now. And one of the reasons, I don't know if you guys take Ambien or if any of your listeners have ever taken Ambien.
Yeah, I have.
Okay, so one of the reasons why Ambien is so useful to people is it only makes you sleep probably about 15 to 20 minutes more in the evening. But you feel tired before you go to sleep, and people tend to forget waking up in the middle of the night because there's kind of this forgetfulness aspect of the drug. Mm. So the point there is that the sense of sleep is actually just as important as actual sleep.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And the same thing is absolutely true in any type of behavior that people seek, right? That the sense of having control over your habits is as important as actually having control of your habits. The sense of feeling productive is as important as being productive. And sometimes people get into a bad place because their sense of something becomes divorced from the reality of it. We call that kind of a neuroses or a psychosis. But what's the point there is that the more you can learn about how your brain works, about how your own patterns work, about how you work, the more you'll actually have a sense of control, which oftentimes leads to actual control. And it's important to shepherd that sense of control in one's own mind, to sort of say, to reflect and say, look, here's what I have control over, here's what I don't have control over. What can I do to get more control over that?
You know, as you're talking, so much of our mythology and so many of our heroes are people who have total command of themselves, right? Their habits. Think about courage. Courage is really an ability to control fear. I mean, it's not that you don't feel fear. I've talked to Navy SEALs about it being in situations where, like, yeah, you're afraid. You just within that fear, you just go into your training. Or if you talk to MMA fighters, you know, big time guys, they're always they're terrified when they walk into that cage, but they've learned to, you know, make it work for them. Essentially, kind of work within the fear. And it's funny because so much of what we kind of admire, if you think about great athletes or great fighters or great warriors, whatever in our culture, a lot of what we admire is the mystery. How do they do that? And they just have a command over that stuff. But the more we learn about the brain, the more we learn that you can kind of manipulate these things if you have command of how your brain works. It feels like it's taking a lot of the mystery out of, you know, the more I learn about, Dan Coyle's book or David Epstein's book about, you know, just what makes a great athlete. Or when you do a movie, when I used to see movies, I didn't know how they were made. Now that I see how they're made, it's ruined movies for me to a large extent. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like I really wonder where we're headed with all this stuff. I mean,
What's interesting is take reality TV because I think you're right. Like some of the removing some of the mystery can be demystifying, but I've been talking to some guys lately who make reality TV, and they've been telling me about how much they have to structure each episode. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really like watching reality TV before, but now that I know sort of what happens behind the scenes, it's so much more fascinating to watch. Right. Because I can actually see the decisions that they're making. Similarly, I feel like as a writer, when I read other people who are great writers, to kind of see the decisions they're making actually gives me an even deeper appreciation of how smart and hard they're working. I think you're right. There are some forms of art or some forms of life where they try and obscure the work, and understanding the work behind the scenes maybe ruins it a little bit. But I've found much more often that actually understanding the work behind the scenes just makes watching it so much more, gives me so much more of a profound appreciation for how smart the person who's creating this thing is being.
See, I like applying it to, like, say, learning tennis or something, you know. You can just get really good at something if you know what to practice. You know, Tim Ferriss always talks about learning what is the 20% of effort. 20% of effort usually results in 80% of the results. It gives you 80% of the results. So focus on where you have to place your energy, and that can be very, very helpful in deconstructing the learning process. But, you know, for me, I like the magic trick. I don't want to know how the magician does what he does. That to me is that I've always been the one who just kind of likes to be a little bit ignorant of how things work. I guess it just depends on your personality.
Well, and it also depends on the area of your life. I mean, the point is that you wouldn't want to be ignorant of how your body or your brain works, because obviously that has negative consequences for your life.
Yeah. But I mean, what I mean is that, you know, take God as an example of ours. You know, if you talk to a theoretical physicist, they're gonna tell you that, you know, well, they're going to define what empty space is and how the universe could have come from nothing or how it was infinite. No, I don't want to live in that world. It's not that I go to church ever because I'll catch fire. But I like to believe that there's some benevolent force and there's a contract to life. And if I behave a certain way, there's a wonderful mystery to things. And at the end of the day, this is all for something. I want to live in that world. I'm not saying that I can defend it necessarily, but in a way, I think we all. Yes, you want to. Human beings are curious. Yes, you want to deconstruct the learning process. Yes, you want to learn what's going on behind the scenes, and we should. And that's sort of the. I mean, the study of science is the study of causation, isn't it? But at the end of the day, I want to keep some mystery. So damn you, Charles.
But you're talking about two different things. I mean, you're talking about one of the things is, you know, respect and understanding and really understanding the process. And the other thing is the human need for transcendence, which is what Jonathan Haidt studies. And that you can find that transcendence in other areas of your life, whether it be in religion or, you know, the sublime experience of a work of art. I mean, I don't know. Right. But Charles, I would guess that, you know, sometimes you are transported by a piece of writing. It's not a purely rational exercise. You get lifted
absolutely.
Up by it. Yeah.
Absolutely. And what I think is so interesting, I mean, and there's this really strong concept of kind of American exceptionalism in transcendence, right? That like, if you go to the founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson wrote this whole essay about kind of this transcendent moment that he had on this natural land bridge. And you can see it in, you know, Emerson and Thoreau, this importance of transcendence. And what's interesting to me is that it's such an important part of the American literary tradition, in part because people say that there reaches a point where your insight or your experience or something happens that you can't find a rational explanation for and that moves you beyond your ability to think through it, right? I mean,
I love that, Charles. I love that.
Yeah, and as a result, kind of knowing, like, kind of understanding behind the scenes in no ways muddies the transcendence, because what is happening happens despite your knowledge of it. I was just out in Los Angeles, and I went to see the James Turrell exhibit at the LACMA. Uh-huh. James Turrell is the artist who creates these light installments. And the thing about it is that you walk into one of his pieces. He has this huge white room. It's essentially a seamless room. One wall is this huge colored, like, it's just light emanating from this wall, and you can't really tell where it's emanating from. And you understand everything that's going on, right? You can look around and you can see this is a seamless room. I understand they painted it white. This is like a wall that's probably some type of plastic. And yet as you stand in front of it, because it takes up your whole field of vision, you begin visually hallucinating. You can't stop yourself from visually hallucinating. And that's what's amazing to me, is that I understand everything that's going on around me. I'm not doing like any weird drugs or anything like that.
Yeah.
I understand I'm actually having a visual hallucination, and I can't stop it or control it. Like, I am being brought to a place where I'm having where I'm essentially transcending my ability to control what's going on by my own choice, with my own volition. And I understand every step of the way, and that doesn't diminish the power
absolutely.
Of this, like, extraordinary experience.
Yeah,
that's really
and it's the same. I mean, you know, because I, you know, as a writer as well, I mean, that duality, the ability to appreciate the craft and at the same time be transported by a great piece of writing. I mean, it's the richest possible experience.
Absolutely.
And the nice thing is that you can then return to the work from multiple perspectives. You know, you can read it the first time and allow yourself to be transported, and then you can go back and try and understand, oh, mechanistically, how did they do that?
Yeah, you bring a good, you're both bringing up a good point. I mean, I think you have to know a little bit about, for example, it's called cultivating taste, right? Mm-hmm. So when you read Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy or The Sound and the Fury, if you haven't done some reading and maybe even some writing, it's going to be harder to appreciate that kind of work, that masterful use of language, for example, than it would be if you were a non-reader. I mean, because you don't have enough to compare it to.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
And to go back to Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, because I like saying Hungarian names.
I'm going to get that
lot.
As a tattoo because I always forget his name, and I always want to drop that name to impress people, but I can never remember it.
Well, I mean, the trick is it's just high twice. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. knee-high.
Yeah, well, you're the polyglot. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, no, it took me forever to figure out how to say
knee-high,
that.
Knee-high, Csikszentmihalyi. Knee-high.
But, you know...
Get a real name, dude. Anyway.
And by a real name,
thanks,
you mean an
thanks,
American
mom and Dad.
Name.
Thanks, yeah. Mom. I'm going to change my name to Callan Mixon Callan.
But, one of the things that he's found about flow is that flow only occurs when the skill is high and when the challenge is high. Mm. So, you have to be, and that's so much of it. I mean, for example, working with teenagers, most of them just aren't good enough at what they're doing yet to find it interesting. They simply don't know enough to be able to really get into that state of flow. And so they're trapped at the position of being bored. And that's the hump that you really have to clear because, it's boring, so you don't want to engage with it. And so what happens is there's this long, you look at teenage boys, for example, in reading, they find it boring, so they don't read, so they never get good enough to really enjoy it. And it's only often when they get into their 30s or 40s that passively they've done enough reading to suddenly find it massively interesting.
Yeah. Right, right. And to bring it back, this actually loops back to what we were discussing earlier about self-control. There's this great quote that I love from actually from Sean Connery, where he was talking to this interviewer. This is back during the days when he was Mr. Olympia and James Bond, and he said that there's no such thing as wasted self-discipline, that any time that you sort of devote yourself to anything that's hard, it ends up paying off in some way, even if you can't anticipate it, which I think is great for people like us, right? Because there's so much of our everyday that we spend where it ends up being hard, and you think to yourself, like, oh, that pitch didn't go anywhere, or I tried to this one line of reporting, and it didn't work out. And yet, I totally believe that like any type of like applied self-discipline ends up teaching you something that you end up using at some point in your life.
Absolutely.
And reading's a great example, right? That like just by like forcing yourself to read something that's kind of hard, I think at some point down the road, you end up being able to read something else that you love. Without anticipating that it's coming.
Yeah, they do the same thing with sports. They find that, if you do a lot of sports as a young kid, you're probably going to be better at the one sport you do. This idea of just practice one thing.
Absolutely.
No, yeah, it's better. And I also had an image of Sean Connery being my father. Just because it's hard doesn't mean you can't do it, son.
Oh, my God.
I'm 007.
I've been reading this book.
That's a bad Sean Connery, by the way.
I've been reading this book called The River of Doubt, which is all about basically after Teddy Roosevelt's like failed run for the president was the Bull Moose Party. Mm. He went on this incredibly misguided expedition to like go down the River of Doubt, like the worst possible river in the Amazon. But at the beginning, they're telling this story about Teddy, and Teddy had all these physical disabilities, and his father comes along and says, "With willpower, Teddy, you can overcome anything." And the guy is like crippled basically, and can't breathe.
I can't stand that shit. I can't stand. Like, listen, no willpower is going to let me run a punt back in the NFL. Okay, I'm going to get stopped immediately. Don't have the bone structure or the fast twitch muscle. So kiss my ass, all you guys with your willpower bullshit. But that's how I was raised, man.
But Teddy did it.
God bless my teachers and my parents. Yeah. That is part of the American ethos, man. It's like, willpower, grind it out. And there is something to be said for that.
There's a lot to be said for it. But I think have you read Willpower, the book by Baumeister and Tierney?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I think what's so great about what Charles is saying in terms of like, good habits, but also bad habits is that part of what Baumeister and Tierney's point is that willpower is a limited resource and you should save it for the things that really deserve it.
Yeah.
What I mean?
It's probably a little bit like inspiration. Don't look for inspiration. Just work on your craft and look for something new,
Yeah.
I think that's exactly right.
How has it changed your life when you wrote the book? When as you learn more and more about this, first of all, how did you come across the idea of this? What made you write a book about it, and how has it affected your life?
Well, it basically was something that was just really interesting to me. I sort of had this experience in Iraq where...
What a great opening sentence. I had this experience in Iraq.
I know, Charles Duhigg. When I wasn't winning Pulitzer Prizes...
I was embedded in Iraq writing for the New York Times.
This is the nice thing about being a journalist. I had met this major general, this major, who had sort of changed the habits of this crowd by influencing whether there were... They were having a problem with riots, and he stopped the riots from happening by removing the food vendors from the plazas. And in doing so, he kind of changed the habits of the crowd. And he told me that he basically sort of saw the world through the lens of habits, because the military had spent so much time thinking about habits and training him to sort of guide his troops' habits. And so when I came back to the U.S., I just thought that was really interesting, and I started doing research into what we actually know about the science of habit formation. And then equally, I sort of felt like a smart, successful person, but there were all these patterns in my life that just drove me crazy. Like, you know, I would eat too much or stay up too late and things like that. And I wanted to understand how to make the behaviors I wanted easier. And so I started looking into the research behind the science of habit formation and thought that this was like really valuable and maybe there's a book there. And luckily other people have seemed to feel like that they're interested in it too. So it was a pretty linear path. I'm actually working on another book right now that sort of touches on topics of, for instance, productivity. And similarly, it's this question of like, we're living through an age where we can learn a lot about topics that people have been interested in for years, but that for the first time are kind of yielding to scientific analysis. And that seems like something important that should be shared with other people, particularly in a narrative form where it's actually fun to read as opposed to scientific and boring to read.
Very much so, because it does change the debate. It changes, in fact, I would argue, with the way we treat each other, the way we look at each other, the way we raise our children. You know, that's why this kind of stuff is so important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You're exactly right. It's changing schools. It's changing government, you know, agencies. It matters a lot. And the more that people learn about that toolbox, the more they can actually change their own lives.
Well, and that's what we're really going through, is we're really going through a paradigm shift in our understanding of what a human being is and how a human being works, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. How much of it is controllable and how much of it in some respects isn't, but the parts that it can be controlled, for years people thought were just like the nature of your character, or, mm-hmm. you know, things that were more mysterious than they actually are.
Mm-hmm.
Give me an example of, if you can, how you would change a bad habit.
So I think one of the best examples is, like, I had this habit of always eating a cookie in the afternoon. And so when I was talking to neurologists and psychologists, I would say, you know, I have this friend with a bad cookie habit. Tell me how to change it. And they would say, well, you know, every habit has these three components. There's a cue, a routine, and a reward. And the cue and the reward are really important. So first of all, you have to figure out what the cue is for this bad habit. And so most cues fall into one of five categories. It's usually a time of day or a particular place or the presence of certain other people. So I'd write down these five things every day. And I have a flow chart on my website, charlesduhigg.com, that people can use to figure out their own habits.
Hmm.
And I figured out pretty quickly it was a time of day. It always hit between like 3:15 and 3:45 in the afternoon, the craving for a cookie. So the cue is a time of day.
Hmm.
And then I had to figure out what the reward was. And I thought the reward was cookies, right? Because cookies taste good. And the scientists were like, no, you don't understand. Rewards are much more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
So is the reward, for instance, that you're hungry, in which case having an apple should suffice, or that you need a burst of sugar, in which case having a cup of coffee should do the trick because it'll give you this energy.
Hmm.
And so I ran these experiments. Every day I'd go up, and when I at 3:15, you know, in the afternoon, when I usually would have a cookie, I would get an apple, or one day I went for a walk around the block, or one day I got a double espresso. And what I figured out pretty quickly is the reason I was going up to the cafeteria on the 14th floor at the New York Times was that I would see all my friends there in the afternoon and would just kind of gossip with them for like 20 or 25 minutes. And I figured out that it was actually the socialization was the reward for this pattern. The cookie was just kind of a convenient excuse to go up and talk to people.
Wow, that's really interesting. Wow.
Yeah, and once I figured that out, I could reprogram the habit, right? The cue is 3:15. The reward is socialization. Now let's come up with a new routine, a new behavior. So now every day at like 3:15 or 3:20, I stand up from my desk. I walk over to someone else's desk. We gossip for 25 minutes. I go back to my desk, and the cookie urge is totally gone.
Wow. Wow.
But
you really
have to break down the behavior to understand how that works.
Man, that's a hard thing to do, though, I would imagine. I mean, I never even thought of that. So the rewards are way more complicated than that. I know that drug addicts, I know a guy who works with very bad, severe drug addicts, people who need new livers and stuff like that. And often they are it's whatever that drug is giving them, even though they know it's killing them, it's making them feel better in that moment. But it's always a question of figuring out why they're really doing it. That's fascinating, the causes.
Yeah, it's a really, I mean, you know, I think what's really hard for people is that oftentimes they kind of intuitively know that they're getting these rewards and that the reward is driving the craving and the behavior, but they don't know where to start to begin kind of tearing apart this impulse. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was to really give people a way to understand how do you start analyzing, diagnosing your own behaviors. Because once you start, the second step is a lot easier than the first step, right? Mm. And so knowing, understanding where other people have started, whether it be a football team or a company or an alcoholic or someone who just wants to change how they eat, knowing where other people have started and the journey they've taken, I think makes it easier for you to take the journey yourself.
Well, it normalizes it. It humanizes it. It means that it's no longer, you know, I'm a person who does this. It's like, oh, this is a thing that people do.
Yeah.
And as a person, I can fix it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We just cured, you know, bad habits on this podcast, ladies and gentlemen.
So what do we do about the Central African Republic?
Yeah. Hunter was singing songs about the Congo. I was like,
might be another guest. You guys might have to take that up.
It may be another guest, ladies and gentlemen. It may be another guest.
That's amazing.
I'm just thinking about how you deconstruct. I guess you'd need a psychiatrist, and sometimes
I think the danger of thinking that you need a psychiatrist. You have to remember that one of the things that, you know, I deal with the most in students and with school is that, you know, the only person who ever knows what's going on with the student is the student.
Mm.
You know, like students are very, very good at like saying appropriate answers, like I need to study more, I need to focus more, and all that sort of stuff. And I think so much of what you're saying, which is so great, Charles, is that it's really about you and the privacy of your own head, without any shame or any embarrassment, really looking at why do you do the things that you do, which is something that only you will ever truly know. You know what I mean? A psychiatrist is only as good as what you tell him.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that in a lot of ways, you know, obviously having someone who can help you through this process. And one of the things we know from the science is that there's a huge amount of productive work that comes from thinking about and talking about habits in a group. In part because a group helps you sort of like just forces you to vocalize your behaviors and to sort of analyze them a little bit more objectively, but equally because something happens in a group where you're sitting in a room, and this happens in AA all the time. This is one of the reasons why Alcoholics Anonymous happens in these group settings, is that someone will be sitting in a room and they'll have like a positive, you know, experience, and the rest of the crowd will kind of applaud them and make them feel good about themselves. There's some positive reinforcement there. But then some guy across the room will say, hey, I've been sober for, you know, 10 years. And someone sitting there will see that guy and think to himself, you know, Bob's kind of an idiot. If Bob can be sober for 10 years, I can definitely be sober for 10 years because I think I'm better than Bob.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to downplay actually how important this influence is of sort of competitive or negative peer comparisons. And yet we know that it absolutely matters. Mm-hmm. We know that if you want to change a habit, you should do it with a group of other people. In part because you'll have friends who will be encouraging you, and in part because there will be people who you think to yourself, that guy's a moron. If he can do it, I absolutely can do it also.
There's no question that AA works. It's saved a lot of lives, man.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
And I think also part of what we're seeing in terms of that change of the understanding of human beings is, you know, we've the last century has really been about the idea of the individual, right? That, you know, you do it on your own and all that sort of stuff. And part of what we're realizing is that's not how we're wired. We're wired to do things in groups. We're wired to do things collaboratively.
Mm.
Right, absolutely. There's a huge, huge amount of science that shows that we are essentially social creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean that we have to be social all the time, right? Being an introvert is a very natural condition.
Mm-hmm.
But it does mean that we have to selectively choose when we do things within groups, because the group will give you more power. The team will give you more power for certain activities. And if you habitually avoid it, you're denying yourself kind of a tool from the toolbox.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's awesome. That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
I can't thank you enough. The book is great. Thanks for the work you do, and thanks for doing this podcast, man. I'm sure you're very busy.
Absolutely. You know. Thanks for having me on. I really, really appreciate
it. Are you in New York? Do you live in New York?
I am, yeah.
Well, they say that my stand-up comedy is transcendent. So if you won't learn anything, but if you want to laugh your ass off, I will let you know the next time I'm at the Gotham Comedy
I would love that. Please do let me know. Absolutely. I live in Brooklyn. I don't know if you ever come out to like the Bell House or any of the clubs that are out here. But I
usually do clubs
come
in Manhattan, but you know.
Well, let me know. It's just a train right away.
No question, man. No question at all. I will.
Fantastic.
I appreciate this, and thank you, as always, to Hunter Motz for all your intelligence.
But all I had to do was look at Best Books Ever, and, you know, Charles's name came
there
out.
There it is,
so there you go.
It was on, by the way, get the book, because it was on the bestseller list, I think, for 68 weeks or something crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Dude. It's if you just Googled The Power of Habit, it'll come up. It was, I was very lucky.
You don't take the train.
Although,
you take a helicopter, bro.
Although I will say, the paperback is coming out on January 7th, so people can
wait
for
awesome.
Paperback if they want.
Yeah.
Yeah,
paperback if you're still in the Stone Ages, or Kindle it. either way, man. I look at people like who have real books now. I'm like, whatever, loser. I'm digital. But you know what? I do actually like the feel of a real book. So get the paperback, and we will put it on our website, and you'll sell. Get ready to sell millions of copies.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because
internationally, yeah.
You're a good man, Charles. You
Fantastic.
Do good work,
Thanks,
sir.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah.
Take
See
care.
You later. Bye.
Bye.
Good people.
Awesome people.
Thank you, Hunter, for getting him.
No worries, no worries.
When are you going to branch off into your own? When are you going to leave
Brian,
me in the dust?
Brian, listen, see, this
I
is
mean,
the...
when are you going to realize?
This is the progression from being in parentheses. Now it seems like I'm out of parentheses and there's just a slash. And now you're worried I'm going to defect.
It's going to be that. Now, Hunter Motz, Brian Kalinchuk. Such bullshit. Hunter Motz is actually way catchier too.
No,
Hunter.
Brian, come on.
You guys listen to Hunter Motz? You guys Motz fans? That's what's going to start happening.
No, no. Well, first people would have to start spelling or pronouncing my last name correctly.
Exactly. You'll have your coming out, and you know, just like, hey, Hunter, and I'll just be the drunk in the corner. Hey, I started that, son of a bitch. He took my whole fire. I would have been somebody. Okay. Mother, stupid straight acres, man. Sir, you've got to leave. sir, please. Fuck your tailpiece. Ladies and gentlemen, that's one more in the can. Go to BrianCallen.com. I'm going to be all over the place, man. I'm going to be in Minnesota. I'm going to be in...
Minnesota, Brian?
Dude, I hit every spot in the world, dude. At least in the country.
I mean,
doing
I heard
you're... stand-up. Austin, I'll be in Austin at the end of January. When does it end? Tempe in the middle of January? You probably already would have heard this podcast.
What are you doing the Central African Republic?
I'm going to be doing that. Well, I was going to do it March 6th, 7th, 8th, but I'll be at the House of Comedy in Minnesota.
Oh, that's
so
exciting.
Unfortunately, I can't do it then.
Sorry, Central African Republic.
sorry, guys. All right, kids. That's it for Brian the Kid Callen and Hunter.
The Tailpiece Motz.
Hunter, Tailpiece Motz. Later!
Yeah. You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit BrianCallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to Facebook.com/BrianCallenComedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.